The Tom Woods Show, episode 822.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, all you homeschooling parents, jump off that hamster wheel and quit running yourself ragged. Check out the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. It'll save you a ton of time and help preserve your sanity. Plus, your kids will get an education I would have given my right arm for. Plus, get $160 worth of free bonuses when you sign up through my special link, ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Today is an appreciation episode for Thomas Sowell, the great scholar and syndicated columnist who actually ended his syndicated column just a week or two ago. I wrote an email about that to my email list, and I'm very sad to see that come to an end, but he's 86 years old after all. And it's incredible that he wrote as long as he did. He's just a tremendous scholar. And when Gene Epstein wrote to me and said, let's do an episode together on Thomas Sowell and his work, I thought, yes, that's an absolute definite. That's a wonderful topic. Gene, of course, is the economics and book review editor at Barron's, the nation's premier financial publication. And he knows an awful lot about the work of Thomas Sowell. We've got a bunch of books we're going to talk about. We'll link to them, of course, on the show notes page. And he's somebody you're going to want to read. He definitely is. His syndicated columns are great, but the books, man, that's really where the gems are. Gene, welcome.
Happy to be back, Tom. And, again, every time I talk to Tom Woods, I want to honor him for all the great work he does. At this moment, I want to single out the consistent excellence of Contra Krugman. You and Bob Murphy are a synergistic duo. You're more than the sum of your considerable parts. It's amazing how you manage to insult each other, banter, keep us amused, while just really dazzling us with your incredible homework about poor Krugman. I look forward to that show every week, and anybody listening who doesn't listen to it is doing him or herself a disservice. Contra Krugman is a great show.
Well, that's tremendous. And as you were saying that, I was thinking that I would make some snarky remark that everybody who speaks to me feels compelled to tell me about my greatness, but I didn't want to cheapen the nice remark you made, so I'm gonna keep that at reserve.
Well, could cheapen it. You benefit from having Bob Murphy on. Basically, you really do your homework. You know, you're not pretentious. You know, you really look things up. And I love Bob's little thing about the Krugman contradictions, with contradictions beginning with a K, and that called to mind that Krugman was a deficit hawk under George W. Bush, and then he quickly switched under Obama, and then of course will he possibly? I know Bob said he can't possibly switch back to being a deficit hawk under Trump, but who knows? Who knows what he can pull? That's another classic example of a Krugman contradiction, and we'll see where that one goes.
Well, in fact, just this morning, somebody on Twitter was linking to a Krugman column. Yes, I kid you not, Gene. January 9th, 2017, the day we're recording this.
Yeah.
His column is called Deficits Matter Again. I am not kidding.
Really?
So I would say there is zero chance we're not covering that column on the show. That is going to happen. So,
yes. I can't imagine.
Yeah, so ContraKrugman.com is the site.
Well, of course, you guys will probably find it, but there's at least more than one column in which he was attacking George W. Bush for his relatively tiny deficits in debt at that moment in time, somewhere under the Bush administration. I think more than once he was inveighing against the debt and the deficits under George W. Bush. So for sure, you should dig that up, and I'm sure you will, because you guys are always doing your homework. Of course, the Contra Krugman saves me from going through the pain of actually having to read Krugman. I'm obligated at times because readers have write me and ask me to check him out, but I've got you guys to lean on, which of course is also a great benefit.
Well, incidentally, and I know we really need to get to our subject, but
yeah, sure.
I guess the scientific economic answer as to when deficits start mattering again is, I believe, 9 o'clock a.m. Friday, January 20th.
Oh,
they suddenly start
right.
to matter again. I think it's that precise moment
right.
that deficits start to matter. All right, well, today we want to talk about Thomas Sowell. I wrote an email about Sowell a week or so ago when I learned that he had written his last column ever.
Yeah.
And I said, this is a year, this was 2016, where people have been talking a lot about celebrity deaths. And I said, well, this isn't a death, but it's an end to something that's been very meaningful to me over the years that I've admired and learned a lot from. So I am sad to see it go.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I had no right to expect him to continue through age 86. So I'm lucky I got what I did.
Yeah.
I want to go into some of his the key points that we associate with him and some of his books. But what would be your introduction to Sowell to somebody who's never heard of him?
My main introduction is to say that he's a storyteller. I think he's benefited over the years from having a couple of fantastic research assistants. He's augmented by that. But whenever Sowell, by virtually always, whenever Sowell is making a point, he tells you a story to illustrate it. He's basically, you might call him an economic historian. That's what makes him uniquely readable. There's a dense series of stories. He's sort of novelistic in his writing. And that's why I know so many people who find him so intensely readable. It's sort of like, I could just read him, for relaxing reading. And I would say that also about Murray Rothbard. Who are the people who might be demanding reading, so it's not going to be relaxing? But for Sowell and Rothbard, again, in Sowell's case especially, it's the stories he tells, the illustrations, the fact that he can cite examples from all over the world, just dazzles you for the density of his research. And I think that's his special stock in trade. Aside from the fact, of course, that he's almost always gets it right with respect to political economic issues. And I would say political economic issues because he writes on a pretty broad, he has a pretty broad perspective, as we'll see, I think, once we start talking specifically about his writings.
Yeah, I didn't know about this essay on budget politics that you bring up. So I want to read that passage. Before I do that, by the way, Bob Murphy, co-host on Contra Krugman, just this second emailed me a link to the column Deficits Suddenly Matter by Krugman. And his subject line was, I think this actually has a bow on top, this particular column. What a gift. All right. This essay on budget politics by Sowell.
Yeah.
Here's the passage. He says, back in my teaching days many years ago, one of the things I liked to ask the class to consider was this. Imagine a government agency with only two tasks. One, building statues of Benedict Arnold, and two, providing life-saving medications to children. If this agency's budget were cut, what would it do? The answer, of course, is that it would cut back on the medications for children. Why? Because that would be what was most likely to get the budget cuts restored. If they cut back on building statues of Benedict Arnold, people might ask why they were building statues of Benedict Arnold in the first place. That's beautiful,
right.
Gene.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you showed that to me.
No, that's worthy of Bastiat. Not necessarily Bastiat's home runs, but one of Bastiat's triples. Frederick Bastiat, who wrote great satire, on economics. It pressed a button in me. For me, when I read that, what I'd always experience is usually the headline reads about budget cutbacks, library hours cut back, that the public library is no longer open on Saturday, that sort of thing that they normally pull. They can't possibly think in terms of cutting back on things like, of course, the Benedict Arnold, which is a really in-your-face example. But, of course, that's the usual tactic. I could comment that, here's Sowell who has an unerring instinct about the behavior of government and gives great examples. And yet, we'll leave that alone. But yet he's a hawk on foreign policy. That we have to bear in mind. But in every other way, he is so refreshing. And of course, the contrast, in fact, in that essay, he doesn't quite make the point that obviously if the private sector is going to cut back, if a business is going to cut cut back. They, of course, are going to cut back on the things that make them less money, that earn less revenue. So obviously, they indeed are going to, by analogy, keep the medical care going and cut back on the Benedict Arnold. They're not going to shut down the library, the public library. They're going to do what they're going to benefit their bottom line. They'll cut back on those things if they need to that are earning them least money and least revenue. And so that's the obvious contract. But it's a great in-your-face example about, again, Benedict Arnold versus medical care. And he's spot on, and that shows again his a wonderful instinct for the way the world really behaves.
This phenomenon has become known as the Washington Monument Syndrome after the Department of the Interior pulled something like this.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yes, that's right. What's that? Yeah, remind me, the Washington Monument Syndrome is you tear down the Washington Monument or you shut it down.
You shut it down, and it's the thing that you think will bring the most public displeasure and therefore public pressure.
Yeah.
So the public will do the work for you of restoring your budget.
Yes.
All right, let's go on to the next. I've got, because just let me just let everybody know, I have a list of books that Gene particularly wants to point to in Sol's list of books, just simply because there are so darn many of them. We want to narrow down what we're talking about.
Yeah, it's an embarrassment of riches. I had to discipline myself.
Yeah, it's really something. So I'm going to, after the second one, I'm going to add one of my own. Yes. The Economics and Politics of Race, an International Perspective.
Yes.
Now, this one I never read, but I have enough of the gist of Sowell's argument that I have a feeling I know what he's saying. But you're saying that this is quite a politically incorrect book, which does not come as a surprise.
Yes. Well, you know, I began, you know, I sort of, you know, my story of Sol is sort of like a semi-autobiography as well. You know, what, by the way, you know, Jason Riley, I don't know if you perhaps you've heard of him, he's a disciple of Sol. He's very, very much cut from the same cloth, a black commentator. He was at the Wall Street Journal. He's now actually at the Manhattan Institute. He's doing a biography of Thomas Sol. And Sol's own story is fascinating. Sol actually published a collection of his own letters as well as a brief memoir, and it's fascinating to follow him. Sol was always a misfit, and it really was not until Milton Friedman got him a steady gig at the Hoover Institution that Sol finally found a resting place. That was in 1980, when Sol was already 50 years old and had a rough time. He was a misfit in the army, a Whig rebel. He couldn't. He was an absolutely uncompromising professor of economics. He was flunking people all the time. He had standards. You know, he would never go with the flow. But then once he found his place at the Hoover Institute, he could generate book after book. And this one was published in 1983, and he was very prolific. And this one was a really in-your-face study of race around the world, an international perspective, prodigiously researched. And again, I believe that the fact that he was able to write this had a lot to do with the fact that he was a black guy raised mainly in Harlem. He could say so many politically incorrect things, among others. He made the point that that politics gets you nowhere. He said, well, look at the Irish. The Irish dominated politics wherever they were, especially, for example, in New York City, as many of us knew. But where did it get them economically? He compared the Irish with the Jews and with the Chinese. While some of us thought that, you know, Jews were active in politics, as he pointed out, by and large, for the first 60 years of their sojourn in New York City, they stayed out of politics, and just as the Chinese did, and yet they rose economically. Now, maybe that's not much of a point to make to your listeners, but it was a sort of a stunning illustration of the fact that that politics is not the solution. Then he made another contrast that was, again, very politically incorrect between the Japanese and the Mexicans. He said, let's make two comparisons. The Mexicans in California and the Japanese in California, they were both discriminated against, at least equally. Certainly, you might even argue the Japanese got it worse because they were put in internment camps during World War II. They were deprived of their property and never given their property back after World War II. And yet, it didn't take too many years before they were richer than the average Californian. They were discriminated against, and yet they became richer than those who discriminated against them. Compare them with the Mexicans, who were also discriminated against, far poorer than the average Californian. Then he won't let this go, and he says, now think of Mexico versus Japan. Or maybe you shouldn't even have named those countries. Take one country of a people, and the country has absolutely no natural resources, and take the other country. This country is not only rich in natural resources, it's rich in oil. You would have predicted that the country rich in natural resources would be a lot richer than the country bereft of natural resources, and yet you get the absolute opposite result. The Japanese are far richer than the Mexicans. And so again, the point he was trying to make is that culture under semi-capitalist conditions seems to be decisive. Prejudice cannot keep people down, and neither can the lack of natural resources. That culture, ethnicity, cultural traditions matter so decisively. And why was this important? Because he was inveighing, of course, against the idea, the liberals' idea, the progressives' idea, that if a group of people are not doing so well, it's got to be due to prejudice. And he said, well, if it's due to prejudice, then how come the Japanese are doing so well? Then, in fact, he played another couple of cards. He said, black people, you know, they're victims of prejudice. He said, well, then why is it that second generation black people who hail from the West Indies, not the immigrants, he granted, because obviously immigrants are starting on a low level, but their children, the black children of these immigrants, West Indians, significant numbers, are richer than the average white. How could that be? Again, an example that tries to demonstrate that prejudice under conditions in which capitalism gives people half a chance, that it's just simply not decisive. Then, of course, he told the story of the Jews, which for me actually had a tragic dimension. As he pointed out, the Jews were obviously very successful in Germany, wherever you put them. Of course, he made the same point about the Chinese. Wherever they end up internationally, if given half a chance, they're going to end up richer than the groups that discriminated against them. But of course, that doesn't stop them from being persecuted. That was the ultimately tragic point. The tragic point that it's not a solution to prejudice that you do better than the rest of the population. In fact, they start hating you more. He wrote another essay about the Jews and the Chinese as middlemen, and he makes an interesting point that there's a peculiar hatred for people who operate as middlemen. So this is sort of a rich tapestry of stories which are fascinating in themselves, thrilling to read in themselves, but also, of course, completely blast away the idea of progressives that prejudice matters. And then, of course, he went into the idea associated with Gary Becker that obviously why capitalism while under conditions of capitalism, the bigot gets persecuted, because if he's not going to hire talented blacks, he's going to get nowhere. Because obviously, if you discriminate against talented people because you're a bigot, then the competition is going to get the march on you. So he points out that's why capitalism gives people a chance. Again, great stories and great insights in this book.
On the Japanese and the Mexicans, he makes a point in his books, which, by the way, this is one of my favorite Sowell books, totally underrated, is Civil Rights, Rhetoric, or Reality.
Yes,
Just a beautiful book. It's 140 pages, big type, and yet smashes everything. So he says he's got a lot of stuff in there on why you should not expect different racial and ethnic groups to be earning exactly the same, and that if they're not, there must be something wicked afoot. Of course, he gives us the example: 50%. This was back in the mid '80s. 50% of Mexican American women are married by age 18. Only 10% of Japanese American women are. You think that might have a teensy weensy effect on the life choices they make, the incomes they earn? I mean, how could you possibly expect those two groups to have the same incomes? There's no reason to think that. And then he would add, and by the way, Puerto Ricans are 25 years younger than Poles or whatever. He would say that the average age of a group alone, leaving everything else out, means of course they're not going to have the same net worth or whatever. I mean, wake the heck up.
Yes.
So I also recommend that book. All right.
Absolutely. No, he's a man. I mean, I put it another way. I call him a storyteller. You might also call him a master of the killer anecdote, you know, another killer example where,
yeah.
You know, you draw in your breath. And when we think that, you know, the argument should stop there, the facts, and he's able to assemble.
All right. Let's start making this more of a lightning round.
Okay.
I've had people recommending to me the book Knowledge and Decision
yeah.
since the early 90s, and I still haven't read it. So tell me about it.
Well, you know, I wrote about this book. I dug up a column of mine. I actually put my own put Thomas Sowell into my own file for columns and found so many different hits and was pleasantly surprised. I didn't even realize how much I'd written and been inspired by Sowell. When this crowd of three won a Nobel Prize for their insights into asymmetric information, I then contrasted their rather puny work with that of Thomas Sowell in Knowledge and Decisions. The asymmetric information crowd, that has included George Akerlof, Joseph Stiglitz, they won an award for supposedly, I'm quoting from the New York Times write-up, that they incorporate imperfect information into economics, a concept of odds with the mainstream view that markets are all-knowing and self-correcting. They challenge traditional theory that open and unregulated markets function with perfect efficiency. This is the celebratory statement about their work in the New York Times. And I began my column by writing, the average person must have chuckled in disbelief while economists of the Austrian school had a right to smile ironically. You know, the idea that markets are imperfect, you know, one would think the average person should have known that. That's the sort of thing that any kid on the corner could tell them for nothing. And, of course, the Austrians, Mises, and I dug up a quote from Mises where he talked about uncertainty in the market. There's plenty of slip twixt cup and lip. And, of course, that's obvious. Where are we getting with that insight? Well, where, of course, it eventually leads them because they wear blinders, is that we need government to correct these imperfections in the market. You know, we obviously, government being perfect and perfectly insightful, the market is screwing up, so you need government to step in. Well, I contrasted this with Knowledge and Decisions, the book by Thomas Sowell, in which, by the way, he specifically states in the introduction to the book that it's essentially an elaboration of Friedrich Hayek's essay about knowledge and markets. That it's essentially a Hayekian exploration of how the market manages to sort out a knowledge. He begins, there's a great opening sentence of the book, information, ideas are everywhere, but knowledge is rare. And he shows how prices convey information. He uses interesting examples about how branding conveys information. For example, a garden variety example he cites is, you know, that people are traveling across the country. They want to stay. They need to stay at a hotel. Motels were where they were called in those days. And the market failure must be terrible because how do they know in advance? You know what? You know how can they get reliable information about what's good? What's a good motel? Maybe these days the internet will tell you, but certainly even now it doesn't necessarily. Well, obviously. That's an opportunity for the market. That's a profitable opportunity. So then you therefore create a brand called Holiday Inn. You know, that's what he points out, that Holiday Inn will convey the information, will economize information that the travelers need. It tells them not that this is a posh hotel, it simply tells them that it will deliver on certain reliable services for staying over that night that is associated with the brand Holiday Inn. And so he builds a case about how the market deals with all of the various problems of conveying information efficiently to people so that resources can be sorted out adequately. And then he talks about how government intervention completely distorts, or in so many cases, distorts these messages. And so, again, why is the, you know, I have to say that I looked back on the book, had a good time sort of reviewing my solo library and saying, well, you know, I'm not sure that that I would have been so thrilled by the book if I was reading it just for the first time now. I read it when it was first published in 1980. That was the book, by the way, that got Sol a job with the Hoover Institute. But certainly I found it possible to read it for pleasure even now, because again, so many killer anecdotes, so many great stories. And so again, if you want to get an elaboration on the sorting of information and knowledge in a market economy, then Knowledge and Decisions is a fun read.
All right, let's talk about The Quest for Cosmic Justice. Tell me about that book.
Well, it's one of by the way, I should say that while Sol has at least, I don't know, 25 books published, some of them are variations on similar themes. This one is the one I think that he had another book called The Vision of the Anointed, which had some special things in it, which I want to mention. Vision of the Anointed, Cosmic Justice. He's clearly a somewhat angry guy, and but this I think makes his prose especially impassioned. The Quest for Cosmic Justice, I think, is written with a little less in the way of anger at the presumption of progressives. He contrasts the idea of cosmic justice with the idea of traditional justice. And maybe the simplest example he gives, which, and oh, by the way, almost virtually all his examples come from real life, that a pizza parlor in San Francisco got a phone call from a person who lived in a certain neighborhood, and they asked for pizza delivery, and the pizza parlor said, I guess maybe said over the phone candidly, we can't send people to your neighborhood. It's too dangerous. The neighborhood is too dangerous for us to send our people to deliver pizza to you. And apparently, I don't know. I don't know what's happened since this book was published a number of years ago. An ordinance was passed that required that the pizza company deliver pizza to the dangerous neighborhood. That how can they possibly refuse to do this? And so he ruminates. He points out this is a case of cosmic justice versus traditional justice. It's cosmically unjust that you have to live in a dangerous neighborhood and they can't deliver pizza to you. But traditional justice would say that the government has no right to tell a company where they should do their business. They obviously want to do as much business as possible, and so that they're therefore working on trade-offs, but they found that they simply can't send their employees into dangerous neighborhoods. Now, you'd think, if you want to be a progressive, you'd think, what are they doing? They're protecting the rights of their employees. But the cosmic justice person would say, my God, how terrible that people have to live in dangerous neighborhoods. So that's and therefore would say that you got to require all the wrongs of the past that might have determined the fact that this is a dangerous neighborhood have to be reversed, and the pizza company has got to make that delivery. So of course the cosmic justice point is that isn't it terrible that you're the child of immigrants? Isn't it terrible that your parents weren't nice? Isn't it terrible that you're not good looking? There's so many things that bother us about the world that have to do with the cosmic injustices of the world. And he makes, I guess you might say, it's kind of a conservative's point that the only thing we can do here on Earth right now is settle issues of traditional justice. If we decide that we're going to settle issues of cosmic justice, then we're going to trample on other people's rights. We're going to give the state far more power than it should have, and we're going to get into real trouble. The progressives want cosmic justice. Those of us in the free market, and indeed, I guess people of a conservative bent, recognize the only thing we can really get is traditional justice. By the way, when I listened to that debate you ran about Israel and the Palestinians and the Jews, I wrote that was a sort of another application of cosmic versus traditional justice. If the Jews were deprived of land 3,000, 2,000 years ago, to right those wrongs when they can't claim any titles to the property is a case of cosmic justice misapplied. And of course, all cosmic justice is misapplied. The only thing you can do is trace titles recently. Then you can have traditional justice. The Palestinians can trace titles to the land, and the Jews can't. So, again, it's a very useful concept, because, by the way, he also segues into another point. He makes the point, in fact, he uses examples from Milton Friedman, that Friedman set up, I forget, he was scholarships for black kids. Many of us wanted to make individual gestures to right the wrongs of cosmic justice. And when we do that, that's fine. Mark Twain, by the way, famously wanted, and he set up a scholarship for black kids to go to college. That was Mark Twain. You know, we can make our gestures to right the wrongs of cosmic justice, but through the realm of politics and of law, we can only handle traditional justice. So I think it's a profound statement that, again, making a point that I think is unforgettable about how we're all bothered by the wrongs of cosmic injustice, but we can only handle traditional justice in practice through the rule of law.
All right, now I want you to tell me about a book that has soul written all over it. The title is Classic Soul, The Vision of the Anointed, Self-Congratulation as a Basis for Social Policy.
Yeah, well, that's exactly. Well, soul all over, because, again, he's a fascinating guy. I never met him, and I know you've had trouble getting him on the show. He tends to be reclusive. Lots of things get him angry. And of course, The Vision of the Anointed is a kind of an angry title, but quite just. He does a fascinating little taxonomy of how the anointed try to solve a problem. I'll give the taxonomy. The first one is they define a crisis, a situation that exists that bothers them. And they never bother to ask themselves, has it been improving over time or has it been deteriorating? That's not a question. They just say there's a certain crisis that exists. Then they pose a solution through government to solve the crisis. Then in the third stage, they get the results. And the results invariably, in terms of time at least, make matters worse. It doesn't get better. If there's been progress, the progress slows. And oftentimes, it's not just the progress slows, you actually get worse results. Bad things happen. And then there's the response. In the fourth stage, he cites how they managed to get around the idea that following their solution, the situation got worse. He uses three examples. The one, of course, is the classic case of the war on poverty, where poverty among all groups by the 1960s had been noticeably declining according to any numbers you might cite, and almost, you know, certainly from 1950s from the late 1940s, poverty was steadily declining. But you think, well, progress is happening, but that's not good enough for the progressives. They've got to get involved, and so they pose a solution: a war on poverty. You've got to subsidize poor people. You've got to create anti-poverty programs. They get the results. What happens is that the decline in poverty slows and even begins to flatten, and then even by arguments begins to get worse. So you'd think that if you look at the before and after, this solution could only have hurt, and then you get the response, and the response is usually, of course, well, we didn't do enough, you know. That obviously we are the anointed. How could we possibly get things wrong? And so we didn't do enough. The two other examples. The two other examples he uses are sex education. Where we want to, you know, we've got a problem with the understanding of the use of contraceptives and the rest, when in fact, the illegitimate births have been declining. You think, you know, that society had more or less been solving this problem, but they know we need more sex education. So then you get a jump in illegitimate births, and then again, that doesn't influence the anointed in any way. They didn't do enough, or what they did It turns out that then they have mission creep. It turns out that this wasn't really about dealing with illegitimate births. And then the third example he uses escapes me for the moment. But you get the picture crime, of course. What am I talking about? Crime. The crime rate is steadily declining, and so then the anointed come along and they say that of course the problem with crime is that to use a Murray Rothbard theme, the problem with crime is that there weren't enough playgrounds in the criminal's neighborhood when he was growing up. I get that actually from Murray Rothbard. So we need more. We need to understand crime as a symptom of a social problem. And so the anointed come in and they fix the problem, and then what happens? The crime rate soars. And so it's a series of it's a rather tragic tale of the patterns by which the anointed like to solve social problems. It's great stuff. And shows his broad perspective of the role of government. I mention that the contradiction in Seoul is that he doesn't apply any of these insights to the Iraqi war, but that's okay. He's never written that much about American foreign policy. 95% of what he's ever written, maybe even more than 95%, is about these economic and political issues. So again, I recommend The Vision of the Anointed for those rather striking and rather tragic stories of the way the anointed try to solve the problems of society.
Gene, say something about Sowell's book, Basic Economics. It turns out that, of course, this book came out much later, but Bob Murphy attributes the work of Sowell and Walter Williams. He says that did more than anything else to make him an economist, to make him abandon his old field, which I think might have been physics, maybe, and then instead to embrace economics. I mean, that's a big thing. Thomas Sowell gave us Bob Murphy.
Really? Oh, wow.
How about
amazing.
That?
Amazing. Really? Oh, wow. No, yeah, by the way, Walter Williams certainly is, I think maybe you've had him on. Walter Williams is certainly a great guy as well. And what's funny about the two of them, if you read Sowell's letters and memoir, is that they met each other. Here are these two black guys who came from very different backgrounds. And Walter said to Sowell, I heard about you. I gather you and I tend to think alike, you know. And it turned out they had a tremendous amount in common. And Sowell says, one of the worst things that's embarrassed me is that people think that I'm the one who influenced Walter Williams in his direction. But Walter sprung full blown in his own right. And Walter Williams has written some great stuff too, although never, probably partly because Walter was a professor and Sowell's had all this time with two research assistants to write so many books that he's outdistanced Walter Williams in terms of his achievements. With respect to Basic Economics, again, he tells what might I imagine that got to Bob Murphy is the same thing that gets to us all, the killer anecdote. The fact that, in fact, as he states, let me dig up the quote, he states in the beginning of Basic Economics that instead of giving you the usual graphs about and numbers that economists like to give you in a textbook, he's going to tell you stories. He's going to pull together. He's going to use real life examples from countries around the world to make economic principles vivid and memorable. And he greatly, beautifully, brilliantly lives up to that claim. Economic examples, vivid and memorable. And he always generously acknowledges his two research assistants who probably just work for him day and night to dig up examples that are densely footnoted that can illustrate his principles. He, for example, when he talks about entrepreneurship, about the risks of operating a business, he tells some great stories about one of them, for example, that's memorable is about A&P. The A&P supermarket, which dominated the supermarket business for so many years, but then A&P could not anticipate suburbanization, which sort of altered the game in supermarkets, and A&P then fell by the wayside, lost its market share. And again, stories like that that illustrate all the risks faced and all of the unforeseen circumstances that can arise in markets, I think, are vivid and memorable and illustrate those principles. So I would imagine, again, that's why that book is so special, and he keeps bringing it to expand. Well, you know, one thing that Sowell does, although I guess that's why he did that even with Knowledge. He's always updating his books, often augmenting them, publishing them in new editions with augmented material, or at least publishing them with updated introductions to keep them alive. And I think that's a very good thing to do, by the way, by many writers. You know, the book was published 20, 25 years ago, and you think it still is relevant, updated, augmented. So he's very good at doing that. I don't even know if he's going to stop me. He might, even at the age of 86, he might continue to do that. Every time Basic Economics comes out in a new edition, I always pick it up. I always read it with pleasure. Although we could segue, I don't know how much time we have left, we could segue to talking about a couple of, and that, as a matter of fact, what's funny is that I wrote a column in which I recommended, I recommended Basic Economics in the same column that I recommended Bob Murphy's, one of Bob Murphy's books, free market economics. And I did write that wherever Murphy disagrees with Sowell, I find that Murphy is right.
Yeah. That's generally how I feel. That's true. Let's say a couple quick things, because Sowell is bold enough to be extremely unconventional and go against the grain in so many areas, which is why it's weirdly demoralizing to see him accept fairly conventional views on, for example, externalities or government ownership of certain types of property and stuff.
Yes. You know, he. You know, what's funny is I looked back, speaking of the government ownership part of it, I looked back on Basic Economics, in which he actually, in one paragraph, he sort of weakly, you know, sort of saying, talking about, oh, well, you know, you do have some private ownership here and there. You know, like he's thinking about it a little bit. But unfortunately, he doesn't follow through. There was, as a matter of fact, it was, give credit to another actually fine book, the Economics for Real People on Austrian Economics. Gene Callahan very politely corrected Sowell about roads. He cites, Sowell talks about, he doesn't use the word market failure. And by the way, from everything you can see, by the way, Sowell has no patience whatsoever with antitrust. It's interesting that, Sowell was very influenced by Milton Friedman, who was really his godfather, got him the job at Hoover Institute. And you might say that Sowell basically took Friedman's free market economics and then basically told those stories and the killer anecdotes. You might call him a sort of Friedmanite, but he has no patience with antitrust. He shows how foolish it is. He showed how foolish it was, for example, in Knowledge and Decisions. But for example, in Basic Economics, he talks about the market failure, although he doesn't use that term, but implies it. The market failure of the fact that mud flaps. He uses this example that a car is not going to put mud flaps on the back of its wheels to prevent it from spewing mud on the car behind it, because, you know, there's no economic incentive. You're not benefiting yourself by paying money for the mud flaps. You're only benefiting the cars behind you. So there you have this, you know, this terrible failure of the market. You need a rule, you need a law that requires mud flaps on cars. But of course, Callahan points out, but obviously if you have private ownership of roads, then the road builder is just going to say, any car that drives on my road has got to have mud flaps. So again, it didn't occur to Sowell that you could have private ownership of roads could solve that problem. The other, by the way, and of course, you're not going to learn anything at all about business cycles from Sowell. I use that example especially by talking about Murphy. Sowell is almost says nothing very useful about business cycles. And of course, obviously, you want to read Bob Murphy on business cycles, among others, for sure. But then Sol talks about the evils of inflation, and is very much a Friedmanite by talking about the evils of inflation, effectively. Price inflation, obviously, and all the ravages of price inflation. But then he talks about how deflation isn't good either. And there he confuses the issue. I mean, deflation defined by the Austrians, of course, means a contraction in the money supply. A contraction in the money supply is indeed disruptive, but he doesn't make a distinction. He seems to think that just a decline in prices is a bad thing, and he even cites the late 1800s when prices were gradually declining to show that that was bad. It was bad for farmers, he says. The property values were declining. He doesn't in fact, he specifically says, oh, the problem was that output was increasing faster than the money supply. You had declining prices, and those are a problem. And you'd wonder, Sol, who's so sensitive, understands how businessmen adjust to new information, doesn't seem to recognize that prices are declining by a couple of percentage points a year, then obviously business will adjust. Factors of production will be bought accordingly to plan for prices. Property will be sold accordingly. All of those things, they will adjust. And again, there's where he had a sort of Friedmanite blind spot that he couldn't quite overcome. You know, I mean, Friedman, by the way, had gone through an evolution. Friedman had initially said that antitrust does play a role, but then over time he said he'd changed his mind about that. But I think that Friedman had never quite changed his mind about price declines. Somehow or other, those are a terrible thing. And Sol has that blind spot as well. So that's a couple of problems with Sol. But it shouldn't mean, and again, that's great information that Bob Murphy, of all people, got converted by Walter Williams and Thomas Sol. A fantastic contribution to economic theory and economic progress.
Well, let's close with this final question. Let's leave aside basic economics,
sure,
because that's an easy answer. What Thomas Sowell book should I read?
Yeah.
I want to dig a little deeper into his work. If people, I mean, the average person isn't going to have time to read more than one Sowell book, probably. What should that one be?
Wow. Well, you know, I guess, you know, you always want to go, you know, the default is always make it shorter in these days of shortened attention span. So I guess I would have to choose. First of all, that civil rights book that you mentioned, a relatively short but very hard-hitting case about how civil rights gets it wrong and how it does harm, or indeed The Vision of the Anointed or The Search for Cosmic Justice, because there he makes, with 1-2 punches, with vivid examples, with his politically incorrect anecdotes, in all of those cases, he talks about how the anointed think that they can do good in the world and don't recognize that they're doing harm. And so those three short books, any one of them, I think, would be great first reading. But then you could develop an appetite for Sol and then move on to a couple of his fatter books, certainly Basic Economics. If you ignore the parts on deflation, ignore the parts on roads, that I think is a great readable tome. So that's the way I would put it. Start with one of those three books, Civil Rights, Vision of the Anointed, Search for Cosmic Justice.
Okay, I'm going to link to all the books we've talked about at tomwoods.com/822 for anybody who'd like to get started reading Sol. He started his column relatively late in his career.
Oh, yeah.
And people know him through his columns, but his books had been coming out for quite a long time before that.
Oh, incredible. No, incredible output. As I say, the world is lucky that this fascinating guy, by the way, I'm looking forward to. I've been Jason Riley's self-appointed research assistant. I've been sending him some things. I'm looking forward to reading Jason Riley's biography. By the way, I should also mention that a guilty pleasure. It's fun to read Sol's book, A Man of Letters, as well as his memoir, because once you start reading them, you sort of fascinated by where did this guy come from? You read about how he broke all the rules in the army. You know, as I put it to Jason Riley, who's another neocon, if Sol had actually been in battle, he probably would have won a Purple Heart. But in the peacetime army, he was nothing but a troublemaker. And that too is fascinating about Sol. But indeed, he started to do the column. I actually wrote him a couple of times asking him to do book reviews. He told me he didn't have the time, because I'm asking a guy past 80 if he has any time to do book reviews. His short pieces are also good, but I would still want to go with at least those three books that we mentioned.
All right, so that's what I'll be. I'll have that. I'll have everything we talked about at tomwoods.com/822. All right, thanks a lot, Gene. This was great. I'm so glad we did it. He deserves some, you know, more attention for his books. I mean, it's great that people read his columns, but I bet only a small fraction read his books, and that's where the gems are. So don't deprive yourselves of that. Thanks a lot, Gene.
Sure. Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. Whew, boy, that was one heck of an episode. A lot of books for you to consider reading. I'm telling you, I'm always overloading you with books. But what can I do? That's who I am. You know, I got to be me. So tomwoods.com/822 will have links to the books that we discussed in this episode. Tomorrow, a mystery guest. Now, I know who it is, so it's sort of a mystery. No more of a mystery than any other guest, but I just don't feel like telling you who it is. But you're going to like him. That's all I have to say. So I hope to see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.